Hello, Vet Blast podcast listeners. Did you notice you can earn 0.25 CE credits with this podcast? After listening to this podcast, head on over to dvm360.com/flex and then sign in or register for a free account. Then select the podcast and follow the online prompts to claim your CE.
Hello and welcome to the Vet Blast podcast. I am your host, Dr. Adam Christman, Chief Veterinary Officer here at Fetch DVM 360. Hey, everybody, welcome back to the Vet Blast podcast. We're going to be talking about maximizing that minimum database with your diagnostics and a little twist in the tail that we're going to be chatting about, courtesy of our friends from Antech for sponsoring this podcast with the one and only Dr. Holly Brown. How are you, my friend?
I am doing fantastic, Adam.
So this is really cool to the listeners. So you're going to hear a little bit about a case, and it'll be a fun little journey that we're going to learn along the way. So to the listeners, our wonderful colleague, Holly, she's a veterinarian board certified clinical pathologist and a figurative hand holder. She practiced small animal medicine before, during, and after her specialty training. And she's grateful to have combined her love of clinical practice and laboratory diagnostics that support it. Holly remains in the trenches at a general referral and emergency practice. She loves making an impact at the interface of laboratory data and patient care. Holly recently transitioned into her new role as Chief Veterinary Educator for Antech Diagnostics, exercising her passion for delivering education about maximizing diagnostic testing, which we're going to talk about today. When away from the office, she enjoys traveling with her family, snuggling her sugar sweet bird dog and tripod cat, and dreaming of her home renovations that rarely come to fruition. Wait, have you done any home renovations that have been like, okay, checked it off the list?
Yes, one bathroom that took us forever, one basement years ago, but there's been a whole house renovation that I have yet to get to, despite years of planning.
I can imagine. It's not easy, that's for sure. My goodness. So, well, let's chat a little bit about doing the minimum database. And what does that look like to you and to our colleagues out there?
Yeah, great. So a couple points about this. So when we talk about the minimum database, you know, we all learn in school, whether it's in veterinary school or technician school, that the minimum database is the CBC, the biochemical profile, plus or minus electrolytes, and the urinalysis, right? But indeed, actually, you know, we put these together as a collaborative group, a battery of tests, right? That in using them together, we're most likely to get to a definitive diagnosis or a diagnosis of exclusion, right? But if we omit parts of it, in particular, often urinalysis is dropped off, right? We need the urinalysis to properly interpret the rest of the hemogram and any biochemical changes, right? They actually all interplay with each other, right? So their value actually is in really running them together. You could repeat testing in one area or another without the complete database, but it's really helpful to have it all together.
I guess that's why they call it that golden fluid, you know, to really look at that in relationship to what's going on your CBC and chem.
Absolutely. So, and keep you from getting too myopic, right? So I think we have a confirmation bias that we see all the time, right? And in all of medicine, veterinary medicine and human medicine. And we think we're going on with a case, and then we look at the laboratory data, we can hone in on something without looking at the complete picture, right? And miss something.
Yeah. And normal results are valuable too, right?
Absolutely. So I think that in truth, to show the best value to our clients, right, in recommending testing, is to review the results as thoroughly as possible. And that's not to overlook those that fall within the reference interval. Sometimes we think that during wellness times, if we say we think it's important to run some lab work and these are the reasons, you know, in particular, that reference intervals, as they're currently established and reported, are really wide, right, for dogs or for cats. And so if we can get an individualized patient's, you know, homeostasis, right, if we can look at what their values are when they are healthy, we can much more sensitively detect abnormalities before they fall outside of a wide reference interval. So that's the value of looking at that in health. And so as we review the data with them, we should not only highlight something that's abnormal, right, but commend those things that are normal, so they understand that the value of what they paid for in that test result.
I agree. And I love looking at trends. I'm curious to get your thoughts on that too. Even when they're wellness too, they're looking good and maybe they're on the higher end of the normal reference lab. What does that mean to you when you're looking at data like that?
100% right. Because again, those reference intervals are wide. And so what's healthy for a one-year-old intact female chihuahua, through a 12-year-old malnourished newfie at the end of his life. Like, those are almost different species, right? So I feel like if we're saying it's normal for them, but it gives you a very wide reference interval. And indeed, for an individual patient, you know, normal is going to be a much more narrow subset of those numbers. And so if something's trending on the high end of a reference interval or a low end of the reference interval, that may indeed be quite abnormal for that patient. One example might be the hematocrit, right? We have a normal for a dog being between something like 37% and 59% or 64% or something at the high end there. And you could, a patient that starts that they're, when they're healthy, they're at the high end of that reference interval, they could lose almost 50% of their blood volume and still fall within the reference interval, right? Yeah. So it's really insensitive. So really, I think having, again, that wellness perspective, so that way, when you look at repeated blood work during times of illness, you can much more sensibly detect that abnormality.
And what does the value in running lab work mean for also the veterinary technicians and the practice overall?
Right. So I think that when we do more diagnostics, we learn more about the case. Obviously, we hope that we're doing better medicine, right? Because we're more sensitively detecting abnormalities and then more accurately interpreting, you know, the changes, right? So there's the medical value for the patient. For the veterinarian, them having a better understanding of the case, right? We shouldn't have to guess, right, anymore. No, we've all had sleepless nights, Adam. I know you have too, yeah. Right? Where we don't know what's quite going on with the case. We haven't been afforded the opportunity to look more deeply into it, or we haven't been able to justify the cost of doing something. So if we can get an owner on board to allow us to do some testing, we will feel better about our jobs, right? And the work that we're doing. But also the lab is a great place to engage our veterinary technicians. They do so much of the hands-on work with the patients. And when they know what's going on with the case, not only do they help with the diagnostics, but I think their conversations with the owners and their treatments of the patients are more effective as well.
100%, because they're part of the, it's, I always feel like it's a teamwork approach to medicine. So you get your technicians on board and learning about the situation. And then you get the pet parents too, because I feel like, I don't know about you, but I feel like more than ever that pet parents want to keep a copy of the lab work results. Do you find that too?
Absolutely. And they really do engage as you start to go over the results. I mean, it's one of the advantages if we do the testing and point of care, right, is that it's easier to go through the data when we can look at them live over the phone. That can be challenging. But again, to not undervalue the normal results as we go over those findings with them. So they understand when we run a CBC, it's not one test, right? We're looking at, you know, 20 different measurements maybe. And as we look at the biochemical profile, letting them know all the organ systems that we looked at, whether they're normal or abnormal.
I had a pet parent, she told me a few weeks ago when she looked at the blood, she's like, you got all of that from those red and purple top tubes.
Right? Isn't that amazing? Yes, yeah. That's the value. Exactly. Yeah.
Bingo, that's exactly right. So I do think there's so much information when you share that with the pet parent, they can see those things. The other thing I was thinking of when you were talking, we always had these teachable moments within our hospital for technicians because there's certain breed specific, I don't want to say abnormalities, but that are normal to the breed, for example, Greyhounds or King Charles Cavalier. Do you think that's important to teach the staff what those things look like?
Absolutely, right? Because those could be missteps, unfortunately, right? And missed opportunities both for education of an owner who may not know as well. And I think that whether it's breed specific or even just patient specific, once we identify what's normal for them, right? Again, we're much more accurately interpreting any other changes.
I love it. Okay, so we chatted early on the pod. We had another podcast to the listeners too, so I encourage you to take a listen to it. It's really good about a patient named Sally. And to the listeners that maybe haven't heard about it, Dr. Holly, can you tell us a little bit about Sally's case?
Yeah, so Sally is a 3-year-old female intact beagle, and she presented to our hospital with the owner reporting she had been dripping blood from the back end, right? And so it was quite nebulous, and he wasn't comfortable telling us more about the anatomy of the back end where he thought he saw the blood. And I think that the beginning of her story, he said otherwise he believed she was clinically healthy. And I think, again, if we don't run laboratory work and we don't get objective data about our patients, some of our first thoughts are, well, she's intact, right? So she may be in heat. And that would be an obvious thought of something physiologic and normal, right? But she wasn't. And he was actually aware of her heat cycle. And this was not during her heat cycle, no swollen vulva, no bloody discharge from the vulva. Then maybe the next thought, well, in this clinician's mind, was that this was going to be bloody urine. And he actually thought that she was maybe had gotten into an anticoagulant rodenticide. And so he thought that's why she might have bloody urine. And again, if he went with that notion, we would have been totally off base again without doing more diagnostics. And then so once we find out that was indeed urine, but she didn't have a coagulopathy, her coag times are normal, then you might think a urinary tract infection, systolith, something like that. But that wasn't the case either. So as we processed her urine as the first part of her minimum database in her case, it turned out she had red pigmented urine, but it wasn't because of red blood cells. So when they spun down the urine to look at the urine sediment, the urine did not clear and there wasn't a pelt of red blood cells at the bottom, right? So it remained pigmented throughout. And when they looked at the urine sediment, there were no intact red blood cells. So now we realize that we were overstating, right? We were calling this hematuria since we had collected it, but now we realize this was actually pigmenturia, just dark red pigmented urine. The differentials being at that point that could have been intact red blood cells, but when we realized it wasn't, that's either because of free hemoglobin from ruptured red blood cells or myoglobin from our muscle cells. So then we have to investigate a little further, right? So one next thing you can do is spin down the blood. And if the plasma remains pink, right, on a spun down hematocrit tube, let's say, we spin that down, the plasma is pink. We do know that's hemolysis, right? We're used to seeing that from when it is a cause of our phlebotomy, right? So we recognize hemolysis and myoglobin, if that's what was pigmenting the urine, all of these come from the blood. If that had been in the blood, it actually clears the blood much more quickly and won't pigment the blood. So now we can do a two-step process, right? We spun down the urine and realized it did not clear, right? So she has this pigmenturia that's either hemoglobinuria or myoglobinuria. And then we spin down the blood. And since that was pigmented pink, we know it was from hemoglobinemia. So then we have to look at her CBC and understand what is happening to rupture those red blood cells, right? To release that free hemoglobin. So as we looked at her CBC, she did have a regenerative anemia. And when we looked at the blood film to understand why, we see that she has Heinz bodies on her red blood cells.
All right. So Heinz bodies. Okay. It's taking me back to vet school here a little bit, Dr. Holly. So can you remind us a little bit about what Heinz bodies are and how they're
identified? Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yes. So Heinz bodies are going to have, they're going to be red blood cells that have little nose protrusions on them. They'll look more like spherocytes. So they'll lack the central pallor we typically see in canine red blood cells. And they have these protrusions on them. And that is caused by the red cells being exposed to an oxidant and it cross-links that red cell membrane. And so it takes that biconcave disc with that excess membrane, it cross-links some of that membrane. So now it's like a spheroid cell. It's rounded it out like a water balloon with a little nose protrusion on it. And so that occurs because the body's been exposed to an oxidant. So now we have to figure out in Sally's case, what was she exposed to? So I don't know if you have a list, if you remember differentials in your mind, there's a couple that come to the top of the list, right? As we think about this, we're asking dad about it and was she exposed to any onions or garlic or the brassica species of plants? And he said, no. We talk about Tylenol, acetaminophen toxicity. And he said, no risk of exposure. We get to zinc toxicosis, right? So that's one of the things we see, especially for US pennies that are minted after 1982, their zinc content on the inside is really high. So when they ingest those pennies, the stomach acids break down the outer coating, and then they get exposed to the zinc on the inside. There's other less common causes in cats, repeated propofol administration. We know that skunk musk can cause it. So other more unusual causes. We asked dad if we could take a lateral radiograph, or one of the most common things that we will do next diagnostically to understand if there's any metal or zinc foreign bodies. And indeed, she had four coins in her stomach. Yes. So I'll tell you, it gets a little strange here though, Adam, because the first thing was that actually when we showed dad the radiograph, he said, oh, my cat did this last year, which I thought was super strange, right? Because I didn't think cats really ate coins. And both in his household, it just made me wonder sort of like what's on his pennies or something. I don't know. But then when we ultimately went in surgically, well, so we tried endoscopically to remove the coins, but we were unable to. And so they did a simple gastrotomy and they removed the coins. And it turns out there was one nickel, which is not part of the story, and three pennies. But the pennies were all minted before 1982, before the zinc contents were high. It turns out these were not the implicated pennies that actually
caused her. That wasn't the reason?
No, but how could they not be related?
Right.
So on further inquisition, she had vomited a couple of times over the weekend. He doesn't watch her use the restroom outside. So she may have defecated or vomited up the coins and he just didn't realize the implicated coins that actually were minted pennies minted after 1902, because what are the chances, right? Known coin ingestion and a Heinz body anemia. So she was a pretty interesting case. And as it turned out, just to complete her minimum database, you know, in looking at a biochemical profile, she did have some pancreatitis where her pancreatic enzymes are elevated. She made an abdominal ultrasound, which supported it with some imaging changes of the pancreas. And that's a common sequela too. We did see her BUN was disproportionately elevated to her creatinine because of GI bleeding as well. So we saw changes in her biochemical profile that also supported this supposition.
That's unbelievable. Wow, what a great case. Okay, so here's my question for you, because I get asked this from new graduates too. When you have a zinc toxicosis or any types of, at what point do you recheck the CBC chemistry UA?
Yeah, great. Well, so I'm all about, like you and I have said before, trending data, right? Yeah. I'm all about that. So for her, especially because we actually weren't able to remove the known implication, right? We actually don't know for sure what caused hers. And she had a fairly significant anemia and it was highly regenerative, as well as evidence for GI bleeding, as well as pancreatitis. So she stayed in the hospital for several days until we could trend her data each day throughout her biochemical profile and her CBC to make sure the course was righting, right? That we are correcting for the GI bleed, as well as her pancreatitis, and that the regenerative anemia was starting to settle down, both increase in her hematocrit and decrease that regenerative response. We hospitalize them until everything is trending the right way and we have confidence in the empirical therapy that we've initiated. And then often once we send them home and we're switching over to oral therapy, we'd still like to have at least one more check on them, right? Because now we sort of switched up protocols when we put everything on the owner to administer at home. We know compliance isn't always great and they've lost that IV fluid support, et cetera. So at least one more recheck to make sure we're on course.
Wow, unbelievable. Fantastic. That's such a great case.
Thank you. I think she was. And quite rewarding. And I just think really neat because, again, we think about the biases that we have, right? As we look at our patients, we're all shaped by our experiences. And the thought that she was first thought, you know, again, when people hear the story, they imagine she must be in heat, but she wasn't, right? And there was no other source of blood that we could find on the back end. And then the seasoned clinician thinking, I bet it's urine. That would make sense for something that could drip from the back end, which was astute. And then thought in the absence of clinical signs, he really thought that she was going to be anticoagulant rodenticide exposure, right? Also totally left field. And then when it wasn't that, her coag times were normal, UTI and those other causes of bleeding, maybe, you know, possibly neoplasia, she was young, but no sign of that. And it wasn't even blood in her urine. And so I think it's just one of those fun twists that make you really recount that if you don't get objective data from your patients and you aren't thorough in doing so, you can be very much misled.
Absolutely. That's such a great case to explain that too. The minimum database, and just like we spoke about earlier, just doing normal blood work to look at these trends as they're aging in our clinics, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah, I love it. Fantastic. Well, Dr. Holly Brown, thank you for all the great work that you do in our profession, by the way.
Oh, it is absolutely my pleasure. I'm so grateful to get to work alongside some awesome practitioners. I feel like actually those on the front lines are doing the heavy lifting and I just get to support, but it's really my pleasure.
Yeah, it's great. I love it. It's like you're connecting the dots and solving a mystery.
Yeah, that's what it feels like. Yeah, absolutely. Right? That's how I see it as well.
Yeah, I love it. Well, thank you so much for being on the show. And thank you again to our friends from Antech for sponsoring this session. Again, this is for CE credit too. So don't forget to get your CE credit on. And we'll see you next time right here on the Vet Blast Podcast. Take care, everybody. Thank you for listening to the Vet Blast Podcast with me, Dr. Adam Christman. Tune in next time. Remember, take care of your animals and always stay possum.
Thanks for listening. Don't forget to claim your CE credit hour for listening to this podcast via dvm360.com/flex, where you can register or log into your free account. Then select the CE podcast and follow the online prompts. We hope you enjoyed this episode and we hope to see you soon. And remember to always stay possum.